We're going to continue on with the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta today. But what I wanted today to do for our little introductory discussion was to again review the things that I consider to be very, very important in understanding as far as how we can improve our lives by living philosophically. The first step is, of course, to understand what it is we want out of life. Now, if you don't know yourself, and usually trying to practice exercises like the ones we discuss are a way of getting to know yourself. But many people don't even think about if they have to know themselves or not. They just go on. You'll see that children, most children, not everyone, but most children don't even think about knowing themselves. And most of the reason is, I think at a young age, they are just what they are. But as they age, they take on layers, layers from family, layers from education, layers from their experiences, layers from internal reactions to the chemistry that's who they are, the physiology of their own body, their own metabolism, and the energetic layers that we'll call karma. And through that time, as they get to adulthood, it's interesting if you all recall in your mid-teens to your late teens, you suddenly started to ask, well, who am I? What am I doing here? Why am I doing this? What should I be doing? What would be best for me? And then we have various activities that excite us, like meeting somebody that stimulates us, or going somewhere that's very interesting, or learning something that's very interesting. And all these activities take us away or create distractions from our question about who we are. And then before we know it, we're in this situation, maybe we're in a relationship and people have expectations of us to tie the knot, to start a family, to get a job, to create a home, to have kids. And then the question of who we are really falls by the wayside because we're too busy. And then we go through life and life goes on, it's ups and it's downs. The kids grow up if they're kids, or the business grows if it's a business, and we accumulate all kinds of possessions. And finally, at some point, we reach a stage where something happens and everything kind of falls apart. It unravels for some reason. And suddenly, who we are becomes the major focus. How many times does that person ask themselves, how did I get here? What choices did I make that led me here? Why am I here? Well, if I wouldn't be here, where else would I be? In order to know that, I have to know what I want. But, oh God, I envy those people so much that know what they want. See those people? They're so dedicated. They love it. I envy them so much because I don't even know really what I want. Well, the real secret is not that many people know what they want. They pretend they know what they want, or they follow the regular pattern, but they don't really think about it. They don't reflect upon it. So ultimately, life presents us with an exciting and pleasant and unpleasant experiences. But overall, we tend to reach a level of certain angst. Most people do. And that angst was the angst that stimulated Shakyamuni Gautama, who became the Buddha, to ask the question, you know, well, what is the point? Why am I doing this? You know, I see all around me old age, sickness, and death. And if that's my end, why should I spend my time in this stuff? I don't want to just end up like that. There's no point to it all. Now, in other cultures, that question is not really asked. You just live for today, or you follow God's rules, depending which culture you come from, or you deal with nature. I mean, there are many different philosophical approaches to deal with that angst. Some people who will say, well, that's fate, that's life. There's positive, there's negative, just deal with it. But when they say that, what they're doing is they're talking about referring to a more superficial level of actually dealing with it, as opposed to a deeper level of what really is about existential things. So the Buddha was addressing this question on a very, very deep level. And through his process of answering the question himself, through his study with great teachers, as we read about, through his practices, both coming from a very wealthy family and seeing that was not going to change the end, to going the complete opposite of asceticism and almost starving to death, that's not going to change the end. He arrived at what is today called the middle path. And when you hear that term, the middle path, oftentimes Buddhist philosophy is called teaching of the middle path or the middle way. Now, that's very similar to in Taoism, they talk about balancing yin and yang. Because when you have yin and you have yang, it's a balance. So you come to the middle, that's where everything is balanced. So that's an interesting similarity. So the Buddha came to the understanding that he observed life and he saw, well, everything changes. I don't see any exception to that. So this teaching I have from the past that things don't change, that there's some permanent thing that continues on and on and on over and over, how can that be true if I don't see any evidence of that anywhere in existence? And if there is some kind of evidence of that, then how can I ever know it's real if I can't experience it? So someone comes out of a meditative state of absorption and says, I have just seen my soul and it's eternal and it goes across all the universe. So the Buddha doesn't say, that can't be true. He says, how? What can I do to see that? How can you demonstrate to me that this is real and not just your own personal experience? I don't doubt that you have this experience, but how can you demonstrate that this is real and everybody, it's not just a product of your mind. The most recent Daily Send quoting, people think the Buddha teaches the doctrine of mind. And that's referring to the Buddha saying, okay, if you had that experience, that's interesting. But how can you prove to me that that was real and not just in your head? So the Buddha arrives at a conclusion after his exercise that the three characteristics, right? What's the first characteristic? Anybody?
Suffering. Oh, sorry, impermanence,
right. So if there's everything is impermanent, what does that mean about that thing we're taught that goes on and on and on, which we call usually a, anyone?
Suffering?
No, a soul.
Karma.
A soul, an atman.
The soul.
So we can't have a permanent soul because everything's impermanent and our soul can't be the singular exception. So if a person doesn't recognize that everything is impermanent and that we don't have a permanent soul, then what are that's going to happen to them in life?
They will suffer.
They will suffer. So those are the three characteristics. Now, he's not saying that life is always going to be painful. He's not saying that you're not going to eat good food, have good sex, enjoy great traveling. He's not saying that. He's saying that ultimately on a deep level, there is going to be this existential angst. If you hold to the fact that life is anything is permanent, you have a permanent soul, you're going to suffer. So then we have a problem. How do we solve the suffering? So what does that suffering become? That becomes the first of what?
Sorry, I missed the question.
What does that suffering become? It becomes the first of what we call something. We call four things.
The four laws, the four...
Right, the four noble truths.
Noble truth.
And that's suffering. And the second noble truth is what?
It is possible to alleviate.
No.
The suffering.
Fred, life is suffering.
The origin of suffering. And what is the origin of suffering? It's in the name of our sutta that we're talking about today.
Craving.
Right, craving.
Yeah. The attachment.
Or tanha, right. I like to use the word adhesion because I like that. I think of it like glue or like Velcro. You know, the minute you're stuck together, you're stuck to this idea. I have this idea, I want this kind of food, and ping. Matter of fact, I'll give you a classic example of my adhesion. I was walking through the market the other day and I saw there was fresh scallops and I was attached to, I want to cook some scallops and they're still in my fridge waiting for me to cook them 4 days later. So the attachment, right? And then the third noble truth is what?
Oh gosh, I got
The alleviation, that it's possible to have right. a life without.
Right, the solution to suffering. Right, and that is what? Eliminate?
Craving, attachment.
Craving and attachment, exactly. And then the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path of how to go about that. Okay. Which starts with right understanding. I don't want to go through all of them because then you're overloaded. The first one is right understanding. Understanding the nature, what we just discussed. There's three characteristics in reality. The suffering then becomes a result of attachment and craving or whatever, however you want to call it. The result of letting go of the craving solves the problem, and then there's the methodology. And then one of the essential aspects of the methods is one of the first sutras we talked about is doing what?
Breathing.
Breathing and?
Anapanasati.
And Satipatthana. So breathing, Anapanasati, why does he write about Anapanasati? Why doesn't he just say Satipatthana? These are my interpretations and my offerings to you to consider. Remember, none of this is gospel. Anapanasati, we talked about breathing last time, right? Two times ago, how essential breathing is. And we worked with the breath. So the breath you have wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you always have access to it. And if you don't have access to it, then you're very stressed, usually. So you have access to the breath. So learning how to breathe accurately and in a way that will help to undo the knots of suffering or the knots of, what's that word he uses all the time? Starts with an I.
Ignorance,
undoing ignorance. Breath is the number one tool. But just breathing is not enough. One can refine even more. And then we go into Satipatthana, how to combine the mind with breathing so that we move with the absorptions into the jhanas. And 1, 2, 3, 4 absorption, from the fourth absorption, we move into the higher states. And eventually, if we incorporate what we experience in this process into our life and make that the fundamental way of living, we will eventually reach Nibbana, or the extinguishing of karma. And the point to extinguish karma is not to destroy ourselves, not to kill ourselves, not to give up, not because we don't want to be alive, not because we don't enjoy living, but because we want to be free from karmic effects when we are living. And then once we're past our life, we want that which is us to be freed. Do you follow what I mean? So let's just talk about an interesting point here. Sam, you want to say something?
Yeah. You just said something. You said that we want to eliminate our karma.
Extinguish
our karma. So give me an example of that, what that would be like for you.
Very good. Think about our lives right now, how we're living them, right? All the good decisions we've made and all the poor decisions we've made. That's subjective, of course. Good and poor. Think about the things, choices we've made that we've had to live out, and we couldn't just change them because they have ramifications, they have consequences. And then we get to our death. For us, it's over. But the karmic energy of everything that we are thinking about goes on to be with somebody else. I don't want anybody else to have to suffer from some of the mistakes I made in life. What a horrible thing to give somebody, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, they'll have some positive sides too, but I could think of a lot of mistakes, a lot of poor choices I've made throughout my life that I'm still exhausting the process of. And somebody, when I die, is going to get that poor soul. And so the extinguishing of karma is so that we don't pass it on to anybody. Now, I'll give you a more physical example that I like. It's an example I used. It's a metaphor many years ago. If you imagine an automobile suspended from a cable, and the automobile does not have a front or a back, It's got two fronts. And there are two driver's seats facing each direction. And there are two tanks for fuel. And there are two motors that are turning the wheels in opposite directions. Meaning, if you put these wheels on the ground, they'd go that way. If you put these wheels on the ground, they'd go that way. So karma is like fuel going into these tanks. Good karma, bad karma. Good karma, bad karma is a bad way to say it. In the Pali, it's actually wholesome karma and unwholesome karma. That's what the word kusala means. Kusala means wholesome. Akusala means unwholesome. So throughout your life, you had a responsibility to give somebody some advice, but actually what they wanted, you really wanted also. So you gave them advice that threw them off the track. Unwholesome karma.
It's really bad.
Right? But then you saw somebody on the street who was really in need, and so you gave them $10. Good karma. So karma gets filled. Now, at the moment of death, imagine the cable is cut. The car falls. The wheels are spinning, right? So the car is standing and still burning rubber, as we say. Eventually, one of the engines runs out of fuel. And then the car moves in that direction that the fuel still remains. And that's a very interesting metaphor for how we experience karma. So karma is also a lot like inertia. A lot of people say, oh, I don't believe in karma. It can't exist. It's unscientific. No, that's not true. It's very scientific. If you take a ball up here, and down here there's a glass, and you let go of the ball, tennis ball, right? Boom, hits the glass breaks. That's what karma is. There's an inertia from the movement of this ball. And when the ball hits the glass, the inertia is enough to push the glass over and break it. Then there's something that happens when the glass breaks. Oh, I just broke a glass. I have to go clean it up. So I go to my closet and trying to look, where's my dustpan? My dustpan's down there. I reach out. Oh, I'm just spraying my back. I just twisted my back. I better call my chiropractor. Got to call my chiropractor. I go to my chiropractor. And then as I'm driving the car, bing, someone hits the back of my car and nicks it. All because the ball rolled down and hit the glass. So extinguishing karma is the ball rolls down, or first of all, perhaps we see the ball, that's dangerous. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, those are very simple things. But let's say someone's in a relationship, and they have in a relationship for a few months. We'll talk about, college students. They're in a relationship for a few months. And one gets tired of the other and texts them. I'm no longer into you. Thank you very much. It was fun. Goodbye. Bingo. That whole thing of blowing somebody off by text. What kind of karma is that? Because then we get into a subjective question of the moral and ethical question of having first entered into a relationship with somebody and then wanting to disengage. How does one disengage? Now, there are people that say there's nothing wrong with that at all. And there are other people who'd say, well, I find that incredibly unethical to not at least give the person respect to their face. So from my perspective as a Dharma teacher, I would say that that is a creation of unwholesome karma that will at some point come back to the person who was so disrespectful. Flippant is the word I would use. Is not to go to the person and say, listen, it's not working out. I'm really sorry, but it was fun while it lasted, but I can't do this. And in fact, to do it by text is actually, in my opinion, a little bit avoiding the own emotion. So perhaps that person has just created unwholesome karma about how they deal with their own emotions because they're not giving themselves the space and they're not giving the other person the space. Well, I don't want to hear what that other person is going to react when I break up with them. So I'm going to do this at a distance. So first, they're robbing the other person of the space to response, and they're robbing themselves of the ability to respond to that other person's response. And that's all unwholesome from my point of view, because honesty and communication is very important in my ethical structure. So exhausting karma is letting things peter out. For those of you that are not native English speakers, peter out means to kind of dissipate, to just kind of, like when a wave comes and then it just kind of falls and that's it, it's done. And so ending our karma with this life is kind of letting the wave come, crash on the sand, and then the wave is gone no more. But we're still part of the ocean, aren't we? We're not only part of the ocean, we're also part of the sand, because we've got into the sand and the crabs and all the other things that live in the sand. So we're assimilated into the universe.